No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And it is time for a classic episode of Tech Stuff. This episode originally published on October 16th, 2013. It is called Running on Steam. Yep, we're going to talk about some steamy stuff today. So let's listen back to this classic episode.
We are talking about steam engines today and how they work and the principles behind them. And it really comes down to thermodynamics. You know, you're talking about heat, really, and what heat does and how it changes things. And that's, you know, harnessing that has allowed us to have a little bit of a revolution, industrially speaking.
Goodness my gracious. I'm slow today. It took me like 4 seconds to get that.
You're pump. Slow. You didn't forget to introduce everybody.
We're both on. Huzzah. Yeah. Okay. But so, yeah. So the thing about gases, when you heat them up, they do stuff.
Yeah. They move the molecules and the gases move around a lot more than they usually do. So let's say you've got a liquid. All right. You've got all those molecules together in a liquid. They're chained together, right? They formed this collection of molecules that are all part of a larger whole.
Right.
So example, you got a bucket of water. Those molecules are all bound together to make that water. Now you can separate some water from that, but the molecules within that separate section, they're still bound together. It's not like you've just freed them and they're now flying all over the place. But if you add energy, as in heat, to that water, and you boil the water, that water starts to boil off and form steam. It's the gas form of that substance. And now the molecules can break free of each other. So now you've got these free-flowing molecules that are zipping around at high speed, depending upon how much heat you've put into the system. And as it turns out, they exert pressure. I mean, this has momentum. If it hits against stuff, it can press against stuff. And if you're able to harness that in some way, you can make that do work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, when you've got a sealed container and you create steam inside of it, it's going to exert pressure on the sides of that container,
right,
which can then do work.
Yeah, or explode, as it turns out, depending upon what you've made the container out of and how hot you've made that water. Yeah, because that's the other thing, is that water, when it goes into steam, it's expanding, right? You're talking about making it take up more space than it normally would, more volume than it normally would. And that, as it turns out, is a very important part of some early steam engines, the idea that you can make something take up more room, and as it condenses, meaning that when the steam starts to cool down and turn back into water, it's taking up less room.
Right. It's going to create a little bit of a vacuum that
right.
you can also use to do work.
Yeah. So both of those things, the idea of steam being able to press against stuff and the idea of steam, once it condenses, creating a vacuum, those are the basic principles behind your various kinds of steam engines. Now, this idea is not brand new. First of all, you've got a lot of people who will cite that a certain person named James Watt was the inventor of the steam engine. As it turns out, that's being a little premature to say that he did. I mean, he certainly played an instrumental role in making steam engines practical, but you have to go way back if you want to look at the people who were really the inventors, as far as we know, of steam engines. Like, keep in mind, we're talking right now about the first recorded instances of people talking about steam engines. The idea itself might even be older.
Right, right. But the first recorded instances are from the first century CE.
Yeah, common era. We're talking a Hero or Heron.
Or Heros.
Or Heros of Alexandria.
He was a Greek mathematician mm-hmm. and inventor.
Yep, he was born in Egypt, lived and worked in mostly in Alexandria, but was of Greek origin, and did a lot of different works. You know, he invented a lot of different things, or at least wrote about a lot of things that we presume he invented. It may very well be that he was just writing about stuff that other people had done, but as far as we know, he's the one who originated these ideas.
Yeah, he had a few inventions that he wrote about, a coin-operated device.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't even know if it was like a, you know, sandal vending machine or something, or, you know, put a coin in and watch the lion eat somebody. I don't know.
I'm hoping fortune teller.
It's Zartan. You'd make a, I wish I were big. I don't know. He also wrote a lot about the discoveries of the Babylonians, the Egyptians, and also other Greeks and also the Romans.
And a bunch of stuff about the properties of air, which mm-hmm. is going to come very much in handy for one of these other things that he described.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the aelopile.
Is that how you say that? That's terrific.
That's how I say it. I'll tell you how it's spelled. It's aeolipile. And I do not speak Greek. It's all Greek to me. So and Lauren's just shaking her head disapprovingly.
Can you hear in our echoey studio the rattle of my head shaking at Jonathan?
I can certainly see it better. this room is better lit than our other studio was.
It's much larger. It's like a nice cave.
It is a nice cave. So this device that Heron or Hero or Heros had designed was an early form of what we would consider a steam engine. Although, from what we can tell, it was mostly meant as sort of a decoration or distraction.
Right, more like a toy. And several of the things that we're going to be talking about from these early periods are more likely to be toys than anything else.
Yeah, because
or concepts.
It was the idea of exploring this nature of, well, steam can do these wild, wacky things. I don't know how we would do this in anything. I don't know how we would use this in any practical way, but look at this cool thing and what it can do. So what his could do was, it was, imagine like a big bowl made out of some metal, like brass. So you got a big brass bowl. It's actually sealed. So mm-hmm. You put water in it, but then you put a watertight seal on there. It does have two pipes that come up from the top of the seal that then meet up with a sphere that is mounted on these two pipes. All right. The sphere itself can rotate along this axis that the pipes make. There's some sort of steam tight ball bearings that were involved, I guess. Also, by the way, we don't know that this was ever built, but this was his design.
Right.
So in the idea was that you would put the water inside this bowl, you would heat up the bowl, the water would convert into steam, which would go up into the pipes, into the sphere. And the sphere itself had two nozzles or two jets.
On opposite sides, I believe.
Right. Opposite sides facing so that they would allow the ball to rotate once steam escapes.
The same way that if you attached two bottle rockets to two sides of a wheel and then, you know, let it push it along.
Right. So in this case, the pushing is kind of interesting. So let's talk about what's going on inside that sphere, which, as far as we know, was never actually built. But inside that sphere,
hypothetical sphere.
Now, if the sphere had no nozzles, if there were no openings, but somehow there was just water in there that you had converted into steam.
That steam would be pressing equally on all surfaces of
exactly.
that sphere interior.
So, in other words, if you're looking at it, if you were able to slow things down to just look at things like a nanosecond at a time, and you were able to observe individual molecules, you would see these molecules bouncing off the various interior surfaces of that sphere. But because they're going in all directions, they're canceling each other out, which means that the ball itself is staying still relative to its environment.
Hypothetically, assuming it's a perfect sphere and that there aren't any, you know, major design flaws.
Right. There's not some weird thing there that's blocking where molecules can usually hit. But if you put an opening in that sphere, that means some of the molecules are going to go through the opening and escape. So that means they are not exerting that force inside the sphere on the opposite side where molecules are banging against that edge of the sphere. That makes the sphere move. So in other words, it's not even that steam is escaping. It's that the steam that is escaping is not counteracting the force counterparts are doing inside that sphere, which I think is kind of an interesting explanation when you think about it. And there was a site I was reading where his example was, imagine you have a cardboard box, but you've taken the bottom and the top off of it, and you've taken one of the walls off of it, and then you put a whole bunch of kids in there just running around, and whenever they hit one of the sides of the walls, they careen off in a different direction. But because there's one side that doesn't have a wall, sometimes kids just keep on running, and they're outside of the box. Meanwhile, the kids who are hitting the opposite side where there is a wall are moving the box further and further.
Yeah.
So its forward motion keeps going, but its left and right motion stay more or less the same because they get canceled out by the various kids. I thought, what an interesting way to do that. And now I want to build this, and I want to watch it happen. Probably from, you know, a 50-foot observation tower. I don't, kids and me, that's not a...
I'm picturing that we could use podcasters instead of children.
We probably could, although we've got some kind of lazy podcasters. I don't know. They might, you know, just kind of... push the wall.
Are podcasters zombies?
I mostly interact with them after lunch. So it's always when we get the snoozies. All right. So anyway, that was the basis behind his idea. But he also had another one that would use steam to do work. That was my favorite example. So I had to include it.
Yeah, this one, I had not seen it. But so there was a steam powered temple doors?
That was the idea. I've got this great illustration I'll show you after the podcast, Lauren. I'll put it up on our social too when we get this podcast out. But the idea was really kind of interesting. So in the illustration, there's this altar and these temple doors. And the altar has a little area in it where you could set a sacrificial fire. Now that fire, the idea was that the fire would heat up water that would create steam. It would push the steam into a second container. That container, in turn, had a tube leading out of it, and the other end of the tube would lead into a bucket. Now, from what I can tell, it looks like the idea is that the steam would push into this container, the container would push more steam in through this other tube that was leading to the bucket, and there the steam would start to cool down and condense.
And condense.
And it would turn into water. So when it would turn into water, the water would flow into the bucket. Enough.
Fill the bucket.
Yeah, which makes it heavy.
Pulling it down.
And the bucket itself is suspended by a pulley. And so because the bucket gets heavier, it starts to exert force on the pulley and eventually would pull the pulley so that the ropes on the other side of the pulley would actually split into two ropes, wrapping around these two columns. And as those ropes, the tension grew, it would make those columns rotate. The rotation of the columns, in turn, would open the temple doors. So by lighting the fire, you would entice the gods to open the doors for you, allowing people into your temple. Now, as it turns out, I think that this was probably a lot of work to open doors when you could just walk up and open
and
them.
Push it?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But as it turns out, that's one of the reasons why steam technology took so long to develop, even though we're talking about... just a few decades into the common era, that's when we're talking about steam engines. The reason we weren't using them for work is because there were a lot of other sources for work back in those days. Like the Romans had lots and lots of slaves. And as it turns out, the history of Europe had lots of that kind of thing. It was either slavery or serfdom. Anyway, there was a lot of source of cheap labor out there, so you didn't have to worry about building things to make labor easier. That's what those unfortunate people were for.
Yay.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the metalworking at the time was not such that you could safely build boiler chambers that would really withstand the pressures necessary to create a lot of these devices. We wouldn't get into that until like the 1800s.
Exactly. So. You could build low pressure steam boilers, but low pressure means that you can't do a lot of work with them. They do, you know, you're releasing steam, you're generating steam and releasing steam in a way where it's not exerting the kind of pressure you would need to do anything really significant unless you were to be incredibly clever with your design. But we'll get into that. We have to go a little bit further before we get to that part. But,
yes.
But these were the fundamentals, right, of steam power. This idea of being able to change water into another form and make it do work. It would just take a millennia and change before anyone started to think about it in another, more practical way.
Yeah, our next known fact is from 1543.
Yeah, Blasco de Garay. He was an officer in the Spanish Navy, and we don't know for sure that he actually tried to do this or that what he proposed was, in fact, a steam engine because it's pretty vague, but he was talking about creating some sort of paddle boat that may have been steam powered.
Yeah, the phrase used in the literature is vessel of boiling water.
Right. So as far as we know, the vessel of boiling water, well, you could guess that, well, that must mean that he was using steam in some way. But because there isn't enough context there, we can't be certain. But
right.
It sounds like the idea was that you would use some sort of vessel of boiling water to generate steam in order to turn the paddles on a boat. Very much like we would see centuries later. But the history books don't record any great Spanish paddle boats sailing across various European waters. So I guess we can probably draw the conclusion that this was an interesting idea that was never actualized.
Right.
Or if it was, it sunk. and the next one's 1601, which not that long afterward. When a fellow named Giovanni Battista della Porta wrote in a book called Spiritale of an invention that would use steam pressure to raise a column of water through a vacuum created by steam when it condenses. Now, this is what you were talking about earlier, Lauren.
Right. Along the same lines, or I guess along opposite lines of all of these people who were theorizing that, you can convert steam. Convert water to steam within a closed container, and that will result in increased pressure. That the opposite, if you can condense steam into water, that it will create a vacuum.
Right. Yeah. And that was an interesting idea that would, again, be capitalized on later. But this is the very basis of the earliest steam engines that were doing work. Not that you were using steam to push something, but rather that you had created a chamber where steam, once it cools down and condenses into water, creates this suction force through creating a vacuum and thus can pull something. And in fact, as we'll talk about in just a couple of minutes, that's really how steam engines got their start. One of the nice things about this, and I really do mean it as a nice thing, is that you could use a low pressure steam engine to create this effect. You didn't have to create high pressure to push something. You could just create steam in a low pressure environment, allow it to condense, and then it would create this force all on its own. So it ended up being a much more safe way of using steam power, especially early on before we had really reached the level of machining parts that could withstand those intense pressures that happen when you create lots of steam in a confined space.
Right.
I don't know if any of our listeners are familiar with a little program called Mythbusters. Mythbusters, of course, a Discovery Channel show. I was a huge fan well before I even worked for How Stuff Works. I was a big fan of the show. But I got to see Mythbusters live in Atlanta. They came down and did a behind-the-scenes kind of tour, and they talked a little bit about the various explosions that they've seen on the show. And the reason why I'm saying this is that the explosion they said was the most impressive and most terrifying was the water heater.
Oh, wow.
Explosion. Because when you have that water under, turning into steam under that intense pressure, and if you've cut off all the safety valves which you should never, ever, ever do.
Right.
Then,
yeah, safety valves on boilers, in fact, are one of the terrific inventions.
Yeah. Without which we probably would, well, we certainly wouldn't be here because we'd have a totally different world.
Yeah.
Our world, we never would have had
steam
the Industrial Revolution.
Never would have happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, because he showed that, you know, you could essentially, it would turn a water heater into part bomb, part rocket. And it was just, you're talking about superheated water that's well past the boiling point due to the pressure, hitting the air, boiling instantaneously, turning into super hot steam. So just being close to this, even if you weren't hit by shrapnel, you could be burned severely just from the steam. This is serious stuff. So that's why these low pressure engines were the first foray into steam engines. It's, although we're still not quite there yet. We're just talking about theory at the moment.
Right. I've got one from 1672.
Okay.
This was Ferdinand Verbeist. I'm going to go with that pronunciation. he might have, he was living in the Imperial Chinese court at the time, and he may have created a working steam car or toy.
Interesting.
He at least drew up plans for one. I'm not sure. Again, it's really...
Yeah, it's hard to say. A lot of these things from these earlier inventors, you know, they haven't survived. So they may have one. We don't know if they were ever built and then just were destroyed or lost. Or we don't know if, you know, it just was just in the plans but never actually built.
One thing that I do believe was built in 1679, a French scientist and math professor named Denis Papin from yes, France. I already said that. Excellent. Created the first pressure cooker, which is really a direct application of what Delaportia was talking about.
Yep.
This was, I think the official name translated is the digester or engine for softening bones, which isn't creepy at all.
No. No, that doesn't make me think of serial killer in the slightest.
But by attaching to this pressurized chamber, a sliding piston, you know, and then heating the pot, the expanding steam would push the piston up. And then the vacuum created when the steam cooled to a liquid would pull the piston back down.
Gotcha.
And this is going to become extremely important very soon.
Yeah. There were a lot of other people who were thinking about steam engines at this time. So while it, you know, you would argue that steam engines really didn't come into play until the mid-1700s, it was the 1600s where we had lots of people theorizing about it. They were kind of laying the groundwork that would allow the following scientists, engineers, mechanics, you know, just interesting people who thought about steam power and began to put it toward a practical application. They would follow and build upon the discoveries that their forefathers had come up with. And those included people like, Jacob Besson. There's a little guy named Leonardo da Vinci. He had three turtle friends, as I recall, and was trained by a rat. Florence Rivol. Thomas Grant, Edward Ford, lots of people were really talking about steam at this time. And then that leads us up to a fellow who patented an idea in 1698, Thomas Savery. And he was the one who was really interested in this idea of using the condensing steam to do work.
Right. Well, okay, so a little bit of background on what he patented. So coal mines were booming at this time because England was facing this timber crisis. There were increases in shipbuilding and lots of firewood being used. So coal mining was becoming huge.
Right. So coal was starting to become the fuel of choice in England.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that would remain true for the next couple of centuries.
Mm-hmm. And so he patented this thing that he called the miner's friend. Because a problem in coal mines is you wind up getting water in places where you really don't want water. And
yeah, like where there are people underground
or where you're. Yeah, exactly. That's where you're trying to work. And it's much harder when they're, you know, completely submerged.
Exactly. We'll talk more about that in a podcast that we're going to record immediately after this one. Spoiler.
But he patented this thing that I don't think he ever built it.
Yeah, it was a design for a device that could pump water out of mines using a steam powered apparatus to operate the pump. But again, you're not using steam to push something. It was a design where the condensing steam would create a pulling force that would move some sort of piston, or which in turn would move some sort of lever that in turn would operate a pump and pull water out. One of the problems was that it was even based just on the design, they could tell that it was going to be fairly limited in how far it could draw water, something like, you know, between 20 and 30 feet, maybe. And that would be something that future engineers would improve upon.
I hate to interrupt this steamy conversation, but it's time for us to take a quick break.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I can't fly without my portable chargers and noise-canceling headphones keeping me immersed, and I'd be lost without my smartphone. In a new place, it's my connection to the familiar. I rely on it to get directions around town, I use my smartphone to look up things to do, or, most importantly, where to eat. In countries where I don't speak the language, my phone becomes a universal translator. And heck, it can double as a digital camera, giving me the opportunity to snap unforgettable pictures of the sights that inspire me and fill me with joy. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, let's get back into talking about steam engines. So we have worked our way up to 1712 when a fellow named Thomas Newcomen invents a steam engine that is following along the same lines as Thomas Savery's idea, the idea to pump water from mines. The basic design was like this. You had a boiler, and the boiler's purpose, of course, is to hold the water and to allow that to heat up
to generate
steam. Right. Mm-hmm. So the steam would move into a cylinder, which had a piston in it. But again, it wasn't meant to push the piston. The piston's natural resting place was at the top of the cylinder because the piston was attached to kind of a counterlever arm, and the other end of the arm was pulled down by gravity. It was meant to be heavier than the side that the piston was attached to.
Right. And so when the steam would cool, it would condense, and then the force of the vacuum that created would pull the piston down and thereby
lift
the other side of the arm.
Which would operate the pump.
Right.
So here you've got this pulling suction that is moving the piston downward, lifting the other end of this lever up. And that in turn was actually activating the pump, pulling the water out of the mine. And the way this would work is that once you had that steam cool down, the way they would cool it down is actually inject water into the cylinder. So you've got the cylinder, it's heated up. You've got the cylinder was quite warm. They had to cool the cylinder down to condense the steam back into water. So they inject water into it, helps cool the steam down, pulls the piston down, and then they would allow the water to heat up again. The steam would slowly enter into this cylinder as gravity was pulling the other end of the lever, the heavier end, back down again. That pulls the piston back to the up resting place, and steam would fill the cylinder again. You'd have to cool it down again. You'd do this over and over again. Now, if you're listening and you're thinking, wow, that sounds like that might not be terribly efficient, you're right, because it meant that you had to keep cooling and heating that cylinder over and over, which meant that you had to continuously burn fuel so that you could continuously heat the water to create this suction.
And furthermore, have other people working to cool down the cylinder.
Right.
However, all of this was still more efficient than housing an entire team of horses to do the same work.
Right, right. And so it ended up actually being such a useful device that they were used well after improved devices were made.
Yeah, so, I mean, up until the 1900s.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't until, it was in the late 1760s when you would get a big improvement over this design. But even then, even after that improvement was made, these were very reliable pumps and had been used for quite some time. You can actually see one if you go to Dearborn, Michigan. There's the Henry Ford Museum, and they have on display one of Newcomen's actual engines. So this is one of the ones that dates back to the early 18th century, which I think is awesome. I totally want to do a tech stuff series where we go to different museums and see and talk about this kind of stuff.
If anyone wants to invest.
Yeah. If you guys all think that's a great idea, let us know, and we'll pass those along to Discovery, because I don't know how I'm going to swing this on my own, other than, really working on my hitchhiking skills. Lauren's nodding. Okay, so anyway, this is great radio. So like I said, this was not terribly efficient because of the cooling and the heating of that cylinder, right?
Right.
So if you could find a way of creating this vacuum to cool the steam down, but to not have to worry about heating and cooling the cylinder itself, thus wasting fuel, you could make this a much more efficient system. And as it turns out, there
somebody
was a guy who came up
that,
with that.
Right. Yeah. In 1769, James Watt came up with the plans for this one.
Now, he's the guy who often we credit as the inventor of the steam engine. Though all you guys who've been listening, you know that's not exactly true.
Because he really just took this Newcomen engine and added a separate condenser to it.
Right. So what he did was he essentially added a separate chamber that connects to the cylinder. And so the cylinder would fill up with steam and then move into the separate chamber where it would condense, and still you would still get the vacuum. But because you didn't have to worry about heating or cooling the cylinder itself, you didn't have to use as much fuel. And as a result, depending upon which source you read,
you didn't have to worry about cooling the cylinder. You could just let it continually heat.
Yeah, exactly. Because
which
mean
you wouldn't
from the boiler,
lose
yeah.
so much heat.
Exactly. You didn't have to keep on burning fuel to compensate for the fact that you had to use water to cool it down. So, according to some sources, that would mean that you saved between 50 and 75% of the fuel you would usually use to operate the steam engine. Well, that's what made steam engines suddenly practical from a fuel standpoint. So they had already been proven to be able to do practical work, but they weren't very efficient. They used so much fuel that it became one of those questions of, well, is it even worth it to invest in this? And then with this invention, it made the steam engine something that was truly possible in lots of different applications. And that's when we really saw a figurative explosion in steam technology. There were some literal ones too.
There were probably a few of those,
In fact, that was one of the things Watt was really concerned about. He wanted to continue working in low pressure boilers, low pressure steam engines, because he felt that any sort of high pressure application was far too dangerous to be practical. And he spoke
and
out
against
it. At
the time, they were. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And the thing was that in other areas of industry, there were lots of improvements, like in machining and metalworking. So there were people who were working on building stronger, more secure boilers and engines that could handle high pressure. Watt was just very cautious about the whole thing. So it was one of those, the development of high pressure engines would wait for another probably 40 years or so. But anyway, Watt's stuff, he became known as a genius in his own time. Everyone was crediting him with the creation of this magnificent technology. I'm sure that he was happy to receive that. But in the same year that when he created these improvements to the Newcomen engine, there was another fellow, Nicolas Cugnot, a French military officer, who developed a steam-powered car. And it was designed to tow artillery pieces.
And it could only move at about 2 miles per hour, which is about 3.2 kilometers per hour.
Yep. And so it was never really used. It wasn't really seen as practical. The idea here
was... Because it wasn't.
Yeah. I read about it being it being displayed in Paris where they were running it and it ran into a wall. But since it ran into a wall 2 miles per hour, no one noticed. That's a true story. Yeah. So anyway, it was an early example of a steam powered car, if you can call it that. It really looked more like a long wooden dolly with a huge boiler on the end of it. It certainly didn't look like a car the way we would think of a car today, but it was designed to tow artillery.
Yeah. We will get into some actual steam powered cars
very soon. So 1780, that's when James Picard and Matthew Wasborough build a steam engine with rotary motion. So this is using various levers and other devices like a crankshaft to transfer this reciprocal motion, which is that up and down motion of a piston, into rotational motion. Now, those of you who listen to our transmission episode will know all about this, and that's why I'm not going to go over it again, because that episode nearly broke us.
Yes,
it was
yes,
about cars, which I don't know if you guys have picked up on this. I'm not a big expert.
Yeah, neither of us are really gearheads.
Should have grabbed Scott.
Probably.
Yeah. Anyway, but yes, it translated this reciprocating motion into rotational force. So that ended up being another important development, although wasn't really used in a practical sense for a while longer.
No. Watt had another terrific addition to his engine, and that was in 1783. He created a double acting engine.
Right. Well, this was an idea that ends up being really important in steam engines later on, although mostly used in high pressure engines, not low pressure engines. The idea being that you can you have a cylinder that has valves on either end of the cylinder. And so as the piston is moving toward one side, steam is escaping out of that side and it's increasing on the other side. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it gets to the end, the valves switch. And so the piston moves to the other side and steam is coming into one end and escaping out the other. Now, with Watt's designs, of course, we're talking about using that suction force. So it's the condensing that's pulling the piston from one side to the other. But later double action steam engines would actually use steam force to push the piston one side and then on the other side. In fact, that's how most of the locomotive steam engines used steam.
Right.
And man, I love those locomotives too. But then, you know, I think every kid who got to play with them was fascinated. Certainly people like Walt Disney became obsessed with them. I think that's a safe term. But then we started seeing steam engines used in lots of different ways. We're getting up to the 1800s now, and that's really where the steam era takes off. And you start seeing steamboats, paddle steamers, locomotives. In 1801, a man named Richard Trevithick, who was an English miner and engineer, built a steam-powered locomotive called the Puffing Devil. It could go on short trips, but only on short trips, because he had trouble keeping the water hot enough to generate steam consistently. That actually was a real issue with a lot of steam engines, the idea of how do you heat the boiler properly.
And I believe his engines were the first that were using steam to actually push pistons rather than the condensation and the vacuum to pull.
Exactly. Trevithick was of the school of thought that high pressure steam engines, their time had come. It was safe enough. You could do it. Watt, again, was not sold on this idea, but Trevithick certainly thought that this was something that you could do. And the early ones were still pretty inefficient. They weren't terribly fast. He would eventually build a little locomotive for amusement, really. It wasn't meant as a form of transportation. It was called the Catch Me Who Can. Had a top speed of 12 miles per hour, which is about 19 kilometers per hour.
I think this was in display in London. Some track was already laid around the UK and the rest of Europe because horses would use the track to pull carts along.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
efficiently.
In fact, the birth of the locomotive is really an English thing. We think of it as a very American thing here in the United States because it was so defining of that era in
our history.
Also,
we really like to just take ownership of everything.
We do. I mean, you know, that wall's not so great, China.
Well, I think we need to take another quick break because I've got the vapors. Not really. It's just that's steam related. Okay, bye.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I can't fly without my portable chargers and noise-canceling headphones keeping me immersed, and I'd be lost without my smartphone. In a new place, it's my connection to the familiar. I rely on it to get directions around town. I use my smartphone to look up things to do or, most importantly, where to eat. In countries where I don't speak the language, my phone becomes a universal translator. And heck, it can double as a digital camera, giving me the opportunity to snap unforgettable pictures of the sights that inspire me and fill me with joy. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
In 1804, a London brewery engineer named Arthur Wolfe improved this high-pressure boiler design through something called compounding, which uses excess steam from one piston to fire a second piston and then a third. This creates less heat loss in the system and winds up with, you know, you have to burn less fuel, which is
right.
Great.
Great. More efficiency. Again, making it more of a practical power solution.
Mm-hmm.
And moving up to 1807, that's when another big name in steam engines, anyone who has followed the story of steamboats, anyone who's familiar with Mark Twain is going to know this name, Robert Fulton. He introduced the first steamship to provide regular passenger service in America. Average speed of the steamship was 5 miles per hour or 8 kilometers per hour.
Screaming.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you don't have to paddle, it's fast enough. It's one of those things that another one of those defining images in American history. You think back to things like, you know, like the Mark Twain stories, and they all have this sort of the evocative image of the great steamship. Of course, Mark Twain was a steamship pilot
operator,
for a while. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, Mark Twain, that's a steamship term. It's actually a term for how deep the water is. Which you would know if you ever have sailed on the rivers of America in Disney World. Just pay attention on that boat, because they'll tell you all this. That's where I got it. So I'm citing my source, Disney World. I was just there. I don't know if you know that.
That's where he was.
I was on
his
vacation. So yeah. 1814, George Stephenson.
He was another English engineer,
yep.
And he built a steam locomotive to run on rails.
Yep, and it carried 30 tons of coal, 450 feet. Uphill at 4 miles per hour or 6 kilometers per hour, which doesn't sound like much, but that's a huge amount of weight to have to transfer.
And it was a huge improvement over Trevithick's version, which could haul about 10 tons of iron, about 10 miles.
Right. So although it didn't go very far, it certainly had to carry a lot of stuff and up an incline. So, you know, it was a big improvement over taking like a super long route in order to avoid having to go up an incline like that. Now, at this stage, the steam engines worked with this, like I said, the steam press is on either side, where you've got the piston with the valves there. The valve will control where the steam can enter and where it can exit. So the steam comes in one side. Now, in this case, we do have the steam pressing, right? So the steam comes in on one side of the cylinder, pushes the piston across. The steam exits out as of one part of the valve while steam comes into the other end of the cylinder. The piston keeps that seal steam tight. And then the piston moves back across the way it came the first time. And you've got this process of a stroke, exhaust, and then the second stroke and its exhaust, and it goes over and over and over again. Meanwhile, you would have the piston attached to some other form of device that would help move the whole project, whatever it happens to be. So with a locomotive, it might be a lever that is then connected to a wheel. So one move of the piston would be a half turn of the wheel, and the move of the piston going back the other way would be the other half turn, and that's where you get that locomotive force, where you can have the train moving down the track. And having that steam escape is what gives the trains their choo-choo sound. That's true. So, you know, when you hear the ch sound of the steam escaping, and it goes over and over, ch-ch, well, that's why kids call trains choo-choos. I don't think they do it anymore. Or if they do, it's kind of that skeuomorphism thing. Because, of course, you don't have many steam-powered trains these days. Unless you go to Walt Disney World, where you can ride a train around Main Street, USA. And
this podcast, strangely enough, is not brought to you by
Disney World. No. I was brought to you by Disney World, apparently.
I believe, usually on steam locomotives, it's called a crosshead, the portion that links out from this piston. And that's going to be connected to something called a drive rod. And then coupling rods are going to be what drives the wheels.
Yeah. You usually do have to have a couple of different elements in here to translate the motion properly, because otherwise, again, you've got that reciprocating motion, which is just going in two directions, right? It's either going up and down or left and right. However, you know, it depends on your orientation and the orientation of the device. But that limits what you can do unless you use other gadgets to kind of translate that motion into something that can do useful work. I mean, unless you just need to open and close a door repeatedly, then you could just have a pole attached to it. But otherwise, you would need something more versatile. So by 1825, steam locomotives were starting to be used to haul passengers on a regular basis. But at that point, before then, it was pretty much used in cargo.
Right. I think 1825 was the very first ride of a passenger steam locomotive. That was George Stephenson's Locomotion Number 1. It carried some cargo and maybe about 600 passengers or so. And that was its maiden voyage.
I hear that everybody was doing a brand new dance now. Do the locomotion? Okay. Lauren is shaking her head again, so I guess I need to move on. All right, so 1800s, from 1825 all the way through 1880, we're going to make a big skip unless you have something you want to add in that.
Not really, no. I guess I could put in at this point that the popular kind of boiler that was being used at this time, and this is going to become important for safety reasons, the popular kind of boiler was a fire tube boiler, which basically consists of a tank of water perforated with furnace pipes, and the hot gases from...
Generated from the fire.
From the fire in these pipes that are going through this cylinder of water are what is heating the water. It's a pretty efficient way to do it. But it also means that the whole tank is under a lot of pressure. So therefore, if it bursts, it's going to lead to that big, scary explosion that we were talking about earlier.
Right. So the heating element here are these pipes that run through the boiler. The water surrounds the pipes. The pipes get hot because of the fires creating these hot gases. You also, by the way, have to have something to vent the hot gases out of. So,
yes.
So you didn't just have steam venting out. You actually had hot air, hot gases venting out too, based from whatever the heat source was. See, that was one of the problems that earlier inventors had run into, was that they were trying to figure out a way of creating this hot water. And some of them were doing things like using a red hot iron inserted underneath a boiler. But that heat starts to dissipate. And once it does, you don't have power anymore. So it was only through creating something that would allow you to generate a fire and continually generate. So even though we talk about steam powered trains, if you've ever seen those movies where they're shoveling coal into a furnace, well, you have to generate the steam, right? It's the train's not running on coal. The coal is what's generating the heat in the fire.
That's boiling the water.
It's the fuel that creates the heat that allows the water to boil, that makes the train go and the green grass grows all around and around. So, moving up to 1880, between 1825 and 1880, steam engines are used in practically every major industrial application. And in fact, really, both figuratively and literally, drive the Industrial Revolution. In 1880, Charles A. Parsons invents the first steam turbine. So now we're getting into a way of using steam to not just push something mechanically, but also generate electricity, which would become really important as well. In 1897, or actually really 1896, is when we first start seeing steam-powered cars in the United States, the Stanley Steamer being the popular model.
Also affectionately called flying teapots.
Yeah, if you ever seen a picture of these, they really do look like horseless carriages. When you hear that term, it looks like it's a carriage that's missing a horse in front of it, and it's got one, usually one lever that you use for steering, and that's it. And you just, you know, Godspeed.
They were really popular, though, in this early 1900s kind of period. More than 60,000 of them were produced
in the United States. And 60,000, that's obviously a tiny number these days. But you're talking back then where only a small sliver of the population would have had access to it, both monetarily and just from opportunity's sake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everyone lived in an area where they could get access to this. Also, keep in mind that these machines were usually used for intercity travel. It's not something that the idea of traveling across country really wasn't part of the automotive industry at that point, whether it was steam powered or gas powered or even electrically powered. We talked about electrical cars, and they predate the gas engine vehicles as well. If you wanted to go across the country, you got on a train. Mm-hmm. You didn't drive your car at this time.
Right.
But we get up to a sad time, though. We're getting up to, for those of us who happen to like the choo-choos.
Yeah, as of about 1960, we're going to see the end of the locomotive era.
Yeah, you don't see many places producing steam-powered trains these days. If they are, it's for some sort of amusement park or something along those mm-hmm. lines. It's not meant as a means of travel. There are some steam-powered engines that are still in operation in various places around the world, but they aren't really being produced because we have alternatives now.
Right. Certainly by the 1930s, people had started to realize that internal combustion engines using gasoline as a fuel were much more efficient and cheap to use than these external combustion engines, which
right.
is what a steam engine is.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. So we start seeing this end of this era in around 1960. But it doesn't mean that we're no longer using steam engines. We still are.
Right, right. Partially because we have improved the kind of boiler that's used. Water tube boilers are kind of the inverse of that fire tube boiler that I was talking about earlier. It's basically a furnace that's perforated with water pipes instead of being a water tank that's perforated with furnace pipes.
Gotcha.
And,
so
and
you've got these tubes of water inside a furnace.
You've got tubes of water inside a furnace. And so only those tubes are under pressure, and therefore it's safer overall.
Right. There's less of a chance for a catastrophic breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Although, again, with proper valving, you're pretty safe most of the time.
Yeah. Back in 2009, you know, way back then, a team of engineers built a car called the Inspiration, which is a steam-powered high-speed car, uses a turbine engine, not a piston engine, steam-powered, and it broke the land speed record for steam-powered vehicles. The average speed was a breezy 148 miles per hour, or 238 kilometers per hour. That's fast.
Yeah.
You're being powered by steam.
And I think that is still the standing land speed record.
I know that there's another team working on it. There's a U.S. steam team that's working on building its own steam-powered vehicle that they hope will break that record. But as far as I know, that has not happened yet as of the recording of this podcast.
Yeah, and there are a few companies that are working on test versions of steam-powered cars. There's one called Cyclone Power Technologies, which is working with Raytheon,
yep.
the defense contractor at the moment. And
in fact, the U.S. team is working on a high-speed vehicle called the Cyclone. That's what the name of the one that they're hoping will break the record
okay.
is called the Cyclone.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. They're producing these engines that would fit in the, you know, standard vehicle engine space.
That's a big deal, too. We didn't even mention that, but the steam engines of...
traditionally were very large.
Yeah, because you had to have a boiler. You had to have something that could contain a lot of water to generate the steam you needed. And, you know, you were venting that steam, so it wasn't like you were
recapturing it. And reusing. Yeah,
even if you did recapture it, especially with the old condenser models, even if you did recapture it, you were still losing some. So it wasn't something that you could run indefinitely. You might be able to run it for a long time, but, you know, that's one of those challenges, is trying to miniaturize something like steam power, which, you know, doesn't work so well. Also, it turns out to be a big part of the steampunk movement, this kind of idea of avoiding the miniaturization. You know, you want these kind of bulky things that have lots of character to them.
Right.
You know, they're shiny and brassy.
Unuseful, but really full of character.
Yeah, no, it's got lots of character. It just looks like, wow, you know, that's a great steampunk version of a mobile device, and it only weighs 70 pounds.
And burns you terribly every time you use it.
Right, well, then, you know, that would obviously, you know, be much more frugal with your use. You wouldn't be picking up your smartphone every 5 seconds at dinner. I'm speaking about my own personal behavior at this point. So, yeah, there's still other companies that are developing steam engines for power generation, usually for places in the world that are not on a power grid and therefore do not have access to electricity. There's one called Uniflow Power, which is unveiled a generator back in 2010, a steam generator, or a steam powered generator, I should say. Didn't generate steam. It generated power through steam. But it was meant to help communities that are not directly connected to power grids to deliver electricity to parts of the world that otherwise would not have it.
Right.
So we're seeing steam still being used in applications today.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I want to point out that most of the electricity generated is technically steam generated.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's what nuclear power is. That's what a coal power plant is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We're talking,
you're burning a fuel that is generating steam that is
turning a turbine usually. That, right. Yeah, exactly. Even things like the plasma waste converters, I've talked about those in the past, where they've talked about using the excess heat in order to generate steam that would turn turbines and be kind of a co-located with a power generator. So you'd have a trash disposal and power generation unit all put together. But it's using steam to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's plasma to break down the trash,
yeah,
but it's steam to generate the power.
A level of efficiency of how hot you can get water, how quickly with how
right.
it'll work.
Yeah. And how can you take something that normally would just be considered a waste byproduct and turn it into useful stuff?
Yeah.
You know, heat, we often think of, oh, we lost a lot of our energy through heat. But if you can recapture that heat and make it do work like you can with steam power, then you're in good shape. So yeah, that kind of wraps up our discussion about steam engines. This was a fun one to do. It's totally another one of those look backs on the technology of days of yore that are still relevant today.
I hope you guys enjoyed that classic episode. If you have suggestions for future topics of current episodes of Tech Stuff, send it to me via Twitter. The handle is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off. Starts Friday and open Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the crazy surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get three wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.